The views expressed on the Buckmaster Radio program are not necessarily the views of Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC, or its sponsors.
Hello, everybody. Bill Buckmaster, along with John Couch, John Engineering and producing the show on the other side of the glass. And together we welcome you to the Buckmaster Show on this Tuesday. It's the 13th of August, 2019. You're listening to 1030. Tucson's voice for trusted, independent news talk. There's worldwide live listening on my website, buckmastershow.com, and of course, kvoi.com. All of our programs make it very easy for you to hear the programs. I have my wonderful assistant, Rosemary Brandt, make sure the shows are posted to buckmastershow.com, usually within a couple of hours of their conclusion, so that you've got them there, can listen on your schedule. 790-2040. On this day that looks very much like kind of a mid-September day. Boy, it sure feels. Rick Grinnell is with me in the studio. Rick's been around forever, former candidate for mayor of the city of Tucson, very active in mining. He's involved with the 9/11 challenge coming up. But Rick, am I on to something here? Doesn't this kind of feel like post-monsoon?
Well, yes, and it's ironic that you say that, because every year on my birthday, which was Saturday, it rains, it seems like.
Yeah.
And I was a kid. We were talking just roughly. She said, there was one year, I think it was 12, the rain was coming up into our front door, and that was over Campbell Prince neighborhood.
Well, and it did rain on your birthday,
and then all of a sudden, it's gone.
It was almost like that was the goodbye swan song
for
monsoon 2019, which has been really kind of a bust.
Adios.
Yeah, what about this now, Rick? You're, of course, vice president of the Southern Arizona Business Coalition that's been very active in the proposed Rosemont Mine. You've been active since pretty much this thing was announced. Gosh, how far back do we go? 2007 have we been talking about this?
Yeah, I think technically the initial paperwork came out in 2006.
Yeah.
Then the project.
So over 10 years, 10 to 12 years talking
about
this.
And then I've been on the project 10 years.
And then we have this delay now that a federal judge has said, no, we're not going to allow Rosemont to go forward. Are you hearing this is like a landmark case?
It has a lot of potential impacts.
Mm-hmm.
The real question is going to come from the Ninth Circuit and then potentially probably up to the Supreme Court. I've been pretty tempered in my remarks and comments on this.
Yeah, you've been on some other shows, but you're ready to kind of let it all hang out,
but
right?
I'm very frustrated with our political environment, our current judicial environment, that basically wants to take the role of administrator over our administrative policy decision makers, the EPA, the Corps of Engineers, the Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management. You have one judge who inside of 2 weeks...
Judge Soto. Here in town.
Inside of 2 weeks was able to come to this conclusion, and you're talking about people that have invested months, years in trying to decide how this law was supposed to be interpreted and properly administered.
That's the mining law of 1872.
It's not only that, but also the rules and regulations of the Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management. You have the Environmental Protection Agency. So now we have one judge and his staff basically creating a situation that throws an industry that employs millions of people directly and indirectly throughout our country, provides the much needed valuable resources that we have for our country. We are already a net importer of copper, and now all of a sudden we're saying no because the environmentalists don't want it in their backyard.
Were there some jobs at stake here?
Oh, there was an immediate impact of three.
How many?
300 to 500 jobs.
Right away.
Uh-huh. Tucson Electric Power.
Mm-hmm.
You had the water line that was going to be employed, so now you got two construction operations going on. You have the east side where they're continued to do the archaeological assessments and what needs to be preserved and how to manage it and how to make sure that you do it properly and take care of the concerns of the Native Americans. But you have all this hypocrisy and your previous host on this program,
yeah, Zach, yeah,
was talking about some things, and I'm thinking, here the county spends well over $1 million of taxpayer money killing jobs to preserve something that 98% of the people in this community will never really understand or take worry about. They're worried about, how do I feed my family? We live in a high poverty rate. It's, what, 23rd or 24th poverty rate in the country?
Mm-hmm.
That's embarrassing. We have companies that come here because of our mining industry, and yet we take these same valuable taxpayer resources and do everything we can to destroy the opportunities that come with this industry. It's so far more advanced than it was even 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. We don't have smelters in this country anymore. People say, what's going to China? Well, we got rid of all the smelters because of the environmentalists. Now everybody's worried about China and Russia. Well, guess what, ladies and gentlemen? Guess where your minerals are going to start coming from? China and Russia.
What about the tourism impact?
Well, the people, that's a big, to me, that's a big fallacy. They talk about a $1 billion tourism industry. They're not talking about the Santa Rita Mountains. They're talking about probably Kirchner-Cabner's, the Grand Canyon. There's no doubt people will go out to the area and watch birds. But these people aren't flying in just to watch birds over by the same, by the Santa Rita Mountains.
Do people visit mining centers as
tourism? Over the country.
Hmm.
All over the country. We've had people from Australia, Japan, Russia, China. We've had people from all around the world, Europe, all the countries. That this industry creates an environment that produces an economic opportunities for so many more people. And the hypocrisy, again, I am just fed up with Pima. I'm embarrassed to say we have elected officials that call themselves leaders.
Rick Grinnell with us, and Mr. Grinnell is just livid over a couple of things, including this Judge Soto's decision, which overturns the U.S. Forest Service approval of the open pit copper mine in the Santa Rita Mountains southeast of Tucson. So now this will go on up the chain of courts, and this could be a couple of years, right, Rick?
Probably.
Yeah. Oh, hey, let's try to carve out a minute or two, yeah, about, we've got 9/11 coming up.
Yes.
What's your involvement with what's called the 9/11 Challenge?
Well, I've had the privilege of serving on a board with some very good people in law enforcement, firefighters, military people, that creates the largest 9/11 event that climbs 2,071 steps at the University of Arizona.
Why that number of steps?
Well, that's the number of steps that were in the towers.
Okay.
And then, and when I say the largest of its kind, it's because we not only have first responders of fire and law enforcement, we also have the military. And so we have those three entities that have come together, along with myself and other veterans and some people in this community that just passionately give their time and attention to make sure we never forget.
Were we one of the first communities to do this?
Actually,
this challenge?
Then? You know, it's a different setup. They used to do it over at the 5151,
mm-hmm,
inside the big tower over there.
Uh-huh.
But it grew to the point where they expanded, and then there were some little bit of a split off, and we're going to, mm-hmm, do this group does this, and this other group will do that. But this is, we raised last year over $80,000.
Where'd the money go?
The money goes, this year is going to go to, part of it's going to go to the Eric Height Foundation, the First Sergeants Organization, and also the new Veterans and First Responders Living Memorial out in Oro Valley that Vicki Schutman, the great leader of Mr. Ronald Schutman and Dr. General Schutman, and she and that committee have done a great job, and so we're. And then the other half of it goes to the 100 Club of Arizona that supports first responders, and makes sure that those families and their children get taken care of.
More information where?
9/11TowerChallengeFoundation.org.
I also know you wanted to say some things about Ken Flowers.
I did. You know, I'm like a lot of people.
Why don't you explain to the listeners for the folks who don't know who Ken was?
Well, Ken is the owner of Arizona Parney Rentals.
Yeah, when you see the tents out
tents
on the mall,
on the
that's
mall,
that's
the,
Ken. Yeah, that's at Ken's
business.
At
the book fairs, at the game day grills, you name it. You've seen the people over there.
Generous guy, gave a lot to the community.
Gave a lot to the community. Very involved with Centurions. He and his wife just got married about almost 8-9 months ago, but they've been together for quite a few years.
Mm-hmm.
But what we've lost is another community leader at a very young age, 61 years old.
That is young.
And I'm not going to speculate on exactly what happened, mm-hmm. so I'll leave that to the
sure.
to the medical profession to make that discussion. But more important, I mean, this is a small city. It mm-hmm. really is, and everybody knows everybody. And even though there are some political differences on certain issues, when it comes to supporting friends and people that contribute to this community,
we all bond together.
Everybody yeah. bonds together, and that's what makes to me that is Tucson's claim to fame, if there is one here that we should be talking about.
Boy, the outpouring for Mr. Flowers on Facebook was just unbelievable.
Oh, it was, and then I think
he touched so many lives.
And I think Dave Fitzsimmons.
Yeah, he did a beautiful
op-ed.
Fitz did a really nice op-ed about Ken.
And that's, like I say, that's probably what makes Tucson such a great city. The politics is another discussion, but the people in this community are givers, and like yourself, you've donated your time and energy to great events and sponsorships.
Thank you very much, Rick. Always a pleasure to see you. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, my friend.
Rick Grinnell with us on the Buckmaster Show. Rick, now something very pleasant about bakery goods. I know you love a nice bakery good, don't you?
Yeah, well, you've been looking at it. Yeah, I've got my back brace on, so you can't see my oversized
belly.
Yeah,
there you go. You got it holding it in, right?
Yeah, I'm holding it in.
Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle, one of our great sponsors. Mona's located at the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. They're doing a beautiful job there now with breakfast. They fire up the grill at 6:30 in the morning each day and open for breakfast. They're open right now for lunch. Northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. Their website is monasdanishbakery.com. There's also a link at buckmastershow.com to Mona's and all of our great partners, people who make this show possible. Please give them your support. Shelley Fishman is coming up next. Shelley, give me a thumbs up, a big thumbs up. That means the market. When I see that high a thumbs up, Rick, I know the market is up hundreds of points. Last check, I think it was up 400 points today, which is good news.
Unbelievable.
I know. All right, we'll take our break right here. It's 10:30, The Voice, Tucson's source for trusted, independent news talk. Be right back. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. This is Bill Buckmaster encouraging you to fly from Tucson International Airport. When you fly Tucson, you're standing up for Tucson. A new study shows the Tucson Airport Authority's annual economic impact is $7.4 billion, with almost $1 billion of that from visitors flying into the airport. Fly Tucson, and airlines will respond with more flights, bringing more visitors, benefiting all of us. Type in TUS when you book your next flight and fly Tucson. The Regional Transportation Authority has a 35-member Citizens Advisory Committee working to identify transportation priorities for the region and will be seeking public input on those priorities before too long. These priorities will help guide development of an RTA continuation plan. The current RTA plan and half-cent excise tax will continue through June 2026. To sign up for RTA updates, visit rtamobility.com. As a small business owner, I appreciate the services of a top-notch certified public accountant. That's why Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Michael's a former Small Business Leader of the Year in Tucson. He'll professionally handle all of your accounting needs and tax preparation services. Flowers, Rieger & Associates, 6125 East Grant Road, and on the web, flowersrieger.com.
Hey, it's Matt Russell from the Buckmaster Show.
And this is Ryan Hansen from Bon Voyage Travel.
I am so pumped to be partnering with Bon Voyage on my next culinary and cocktail cruise.
This is definitely a cruise for foodies as you experience the Mediterranean on Celebrity Cruises.
And the private excursions that your team has arranged for us? I mean, come on, an ouzo distillery tour in Greece? A food and wine day on Malta?
We'll handle everything, so all you and your guests need to do is eat, drink, and be happy.
Go to bvtravel.com/Matt Russell to learn more.
Let's say you need an honest roofer. Where do you start? Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona has more than 3,200 accredited businesses ready to help and committed to doing things right. Next time you need a trusted mechanic, plumber, AC company, or florist, go to our website, bbb.org, or call us at 520-888-6161. Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona. We are here to help you find local companies you can trust.
Shelly Fishman, CFP, is a financial planner and investment advisor professional. The opinions voiced on this program segment are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your financial advisor or tax advisor prior to investing.
And it's time for Shelly Fishman. We will consult with Shelly. And my first question after I give him a wonderful greeting. Hi, Shelly. How are
you?
Hi,
Bill. I am well today.
My first question is, what in the heck is going on? And it's the market way up today.
Yeah. So there's this roller coaster thing going on called China and Chinese trade policy. And what happened, of course, is the president took somebody's arm, twisted it behind their back, and then... kind of let the pressure up and expects to be made to think that the person should say thank you, Mr. President, for reducing the pain
delaying the
tariffs that you started to begin with
on iPhones and Chinese and clothing goods
in order to allow companies, he says, to stock up for the Christmas holiday season. Regardless of what the reasons are, the market is reacting well to the fact that those tariffs, for the most part, are not going to be put on the Chinese imports at the moment. And the markets, for whatever reason, have tended to become very volatile based upon that kind of news. So we get bad news about the Chinese trade negotiations, the market goes down. In the past 2 weeks, have had a lot of that, including yesterday. And then today we get a 400-point day. If you're an investor, it is very hard to make decisions in terms of what to invest in, where to stay put, where to perhaps modify your portfolios a little bit. It is difficult because there's no rhyme or reason in the economy to what's going on. Nothing basic is happening that you can point to.
Now, the trade deficit, there's some concern here.
Oh, yeah.
The trade deficits are at their highest level, I think, ever.
Ever.
Does this have anything to do with the situation in China and with the United States?
Peripherally, it does. And you know, the trade deficits are a measure of how much we sell and how much we buy. And so the trade deficit right now, overall for the U.S., including services, is higher than it's ever been, which means that we're buying much more than we're selling. One of the reasons we're having trouble selling stuff is because the value of the dollar is so high. And there's a couple of reasons the value of the dollar is high, but with weakness around the rest of the country, the rest of the world, and some economies kind of slowing down, the dollar value goes up vis-a-vis some of these other currencies. And since a lot of the big ticket items that are traded around the world, oil being one, are denominated in U.S. dollars, when the dollar is high, it makes it very difficult for U.S. manufacturers to export their goods to the rest of the world. Number one, the rest of the world is slowing down, so they're not buying as much. And number two, because the dollar is high, they're looking for alternate sources.
And farmers have really been hurt big time.
Farmers have been hurt. You know, we have this socialist program going on right now called, take the government money and pay it to the farmers. I mean, if that's not socialism, I don't know what is. But we've got $16 billion. It's going to the large farms. It's not going to the smaller farms that are the ones that are really being hurt. But the Chinese have said, you know, you want to play games with us, we'll play games with you. And so the Chinese aren't buying our soybeans anymore.
So what's going on with this trade deficit, Shelley? Why should we be concerned?
We should be concerned for a couple of reasons. Number one, it means that the market for our goods has diminished. The trade deficit is a symptom of the fact that we're sending less abroad, which means that we produce less, which means that at some point, Americans get laid off. And what we're finding, in fact, there was an article in today's business section of the Times by Jim Tankersley, that really talks to the efforts that the Trump administration from the outset has made to try to restore jobs in the U.S., and it's fallen flat. None of it has really worked, and the couple of things that we thought might have an effect on increasing jobs and bringing investment back into the U.S. Had a one-quarter effect, and that's the tax cuts. And then after that, what's happened is that the companies have simply used that money to buy back stock or to give their stockholders additional dividends. And what the advisors, the economic advisors to the administration, are basically saying, well, it's taking longer than we thought, which reminds me of an off-color joke I won't tell on the air. But it's basically the old IBM salesman sitting on the side of the bed telling everybody how good it was going to be, but it never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we had the Dr. Laffer showed up on the Smirkanish show a couple of weeks ago, and Smirkanish pushed back on him about his Laffer curve and the fact that if you lower taxes, it will increase tax revenues. And that never really happened. And Laffer was taking credit for the fact that it finally happened in the Clinton administration in the mid-90s. And you just scratch your head and say, what? After Clinton raised taxes. So you get people like Peter Navarro and Larry Kudlow saying that we're going to get 5% growth. We are going to get 5% growth, and it's not happening.
What
and
about
at
all
some
those
point,
photo
you
ops?
You've got to look at the policies.
Photo ops we saw at those factories early on in the Trump administration showing, I think, like some of these companies saying all these jobs are going to come back.
And you can pick and choose places where jobs have come back. But then in the same town or just across the river, three factories shut down.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you can pick individual situations where, a company decided to repatriate some jobs. But overall, what we're seeing is the increase in U.S. manufacturing jobs has been paltry. And that, at the same time, we have not only trade deficits, but huge budget deficits. And you wonder, well, what the heck are we spending all this money on? That's causing these, we're not doing any infrastructure stuff.
The budget deficit, I think, is the highest it's ever been.
The budget deficit last year we thought was terrible because it was over $800 billion. It's going to be over $1 trillion this year with increases forecast for every year going out to the end of the forecast period of the tax cut, which is 10 years. Now, you and I have talked about the fact that new economic theory would have you believe that that budget deficits aren't important because
right,
you can
print money. Right, it's the new way
money.
Of doing business.
Yeah, you can print money and it's not going to cause inflation. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of conservatives out there who thinks that's, as George H.W. Bush put it, voodoo economics.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was right.
Mm-hmm.
But we are learning that you can print more than we thought.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not in a crisis at this point. But we do have to address this problem of budget deficits. We got to find a way to raise taxes. We have to find a way to pay our bills. And this is critically important to the economy. We have to invest in the infrastructure of this country. If we don't, the accumulated balance of infrastructure that's collapsing will cause the American economy to slow down tremendously because we won't be able to move goods between suppliers and manufacturers, and then manufacturers and customers. And the amount of money that we will have to use to shore up that infrastructure on an emergency basis will cost a lot more than it would if we had a 10 or 20 year plan to rebuild this infrastructure.
All right. In the remaining few seconds, Bank of America yesterday revised their forecast, saying there's a 1 in 3 chance that we'll go into recession before the end of the year. Your final comment
on
that?
Some industry segments are already probably in recession. Some are slowing down significantly. I think we're in for a recession. We'll begin to see it in the beginning of the first quarter. We won't measure it until the second quarter of next year.
Could it be therapeutic?
Well, we can get rid of Trump.
Oh, Shelley.
Well, you know, I'm sorry. We need better policies.
All right. Thank you very much. Shelley Fishman, there you go.
See you later, Bill.
All right. I know. Say whatever.
The opinions voiced in this program segment are for general information only and are not necessarily those of Securities America or this station. Shelley Fishman, CFP, is a financial planner and investment advisor in private practice here in Tucson. Securities offered through Securities America, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through PFG Advisors. Securities America and PFG Advisors are separate entities.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastro pub, serving an impressive menu of craft beer and fine fare. Choose from more than 175 beers from around the world, plus wine and a full bar. Enjoy delicious soups, salads, burgers, sandwiches, hearty entrees, and more. Craft beer, fine fare, great service, and stunning views. Noble Hops, perfect for lunch, dinner, happy hour, late night, and any time in between. Open daily at La Cañada and Lambert Lane in Oro Valley.
This is Moa Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing.
And this is Bill Buckmaster. For several decades now, Moe has been my go-to expert for all my framing needs and bathroom mirrors. I trust Moe for service, professionalism, and top-of-the-line quality.
Thanks, Bill. Give us a call at 795-8226 and stop by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing on the southwest corner of Fort Lowell and Dodge, right next to Copenhagen, and on the web at moesgallery.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
The average person in the USA today takes over 12 prescription medicines each year. And if you are over age 65, it is more than 17 medicines. CredibleMeds.org is a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping inform you and your healthcare providers. Over 30,000 people die each year from reactions to their medicines. Don't be one of those numbers. Be informed and stay safe. Visit CredibleMeds.org today and take control of your healthcare by taking your medicines safely.
Green Things is a family-owned and operated plant nursery serving Tucson since 1970. Open daily at 3384 East River Road, Green Things is chock full of plants and pottery from around the world. Green Things is also now home to Zocalo, featuring fine Mexican and South American imports spread over 5 buildings on the 13-acre Green Things property. For more, visit greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
At Sierra Tucson, we see miracles of healing every day. We are honored to be an international premier treatment center right here in Southern Arizona. Our comprehensive evidence-based programs focus on addiction recovery, mood and anxiety disorders, trauma recovery, including PTSD, pain recovery, and co-occurring disorders. Learn more at sierratucson.com or call us at 800-842-4487. We work with most insurance payers.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. Bill Buckmaster with you, been with you now here on the radio since January of 2011, after 22 years on the TV. So, hey, that's over 30 years here in radio and television in Tucson. And we're on 1030 The Voice, trusted news talk. I've added something new to our little logo here. I call it trusted independent news talk, because that's what we are here. We don't take a political slant, not on the Buckmaster Show. We're independent. We let our listeners make their decisions on the information we give you. This portion of our program is presented by a beautiful area of the southwestern United States. It's Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico. That's a beautiful area of the southwest corner of the Land of Enchantment. It's only a three-hour drive from Tucson. Visit southwestnewmexico.org for the complete listing of great places to stay over in Silver, and all sorts of recreation opportunities. You can go fishing, and there's lakes in the area, and the Gila Cliff Dwellings National Monument. Jeff Silvertooth is with us. Jeff, do you know that area of Silver City?
I do.
You like that area very much.
Absolutely. It's very nice.
It's a good idea. Let's go over there.
Silver City, you could use a break right now. Maybe you'll be heading back, though, to the coast here in a little bit.
Might do that. Yeah. That's a good idea, too.
Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico. Dr. Jeff Silvertooth is the Buckmaster Contributor on Agriculture. We are so delighted to have Jeff and really two dozen contributors that come from all walks of life. These are people who are experts in their field. Professor Silvertooth joined the University of Arizona College of Agriculture and Life Sciences back in 1987. He's currently the Associate Dean and Director for Extension and Economic Development, where he provides overall leadership and administrative and personnel management for the Arizona Cooperative Extension. He also serves as the Associate Director for the Arizona Experimental Station. Is that up in Maricopa County, the Experimental Station, Jeff?
No, we have sites for the experiment station in several places across the state.
You do?
The closest to Maricopa County is in the Maricopa Agricultural Center, but that's actually in Pinal County, northwest of Casa Grande.
Does each county have something going on?
Not in experiment stations, but we have them regionally set. For example, in the lower Colorado River Valley, we have Yuma with both the Valley and the Mesa stations, Maricopa Ag Center in the Central Arizona. We have the campus ag centers, which there are several here at Red Rock, Tucson, Santa Rita, et cetera. Right here we call them the Tucson area ag centers, this Pima County basically. And then we have Safford Ag Center. We have a big ranch up in the mountains, in the White Mountains, the VBARV.
You have a ranch?
It's the U of A. We have our college. Our experiment station system has a lease. It's a Forest Service lease, a 71,000-acre Forest Service grazing lease.
This is the first I've heard of this. You have 71,000?
Well, that's the way these ranch leases, that's about what it takes to run a ranch out here, you know.
Yeah.
So most ranchers are on public lands to some extent, either on BLM, state land, or Forest Service. We have a Forest Service grazing lease.
And what are they doing on the ranch?
It's of course, animal science, range management research.
Okay.
And it's a great extension platform for us as well. Now with the College of Veterinary Medicine, they're going to be using that ranch quite a lot for the veterinarians as they train.
Anyway, we've got all sorts of topics to cover with Jeff. Jeff, it's good to see you.
Yes, sir.
Try to bring you in at least every quarter here on the program. I want to begin with the rain situation. What are your agriculture friends around the state saying? You know, we just got out of being designated a drought area for most of Arizona. This has been a disappointing summer rainy season.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, it has. For those of us that are the long-term residents out here, we know they somewhere like last year was a lot more abundant rain.
Yeah,
and so it has been a little bit disappointing. I'll tell you, in the crop production arena, it really does. The rains don't make that big a difference in terms of our water availability for crop production.
Why is it? Because you have a constant source for your water availability.
There's really three things that happen with the monsoons. First of all, they usually don't provide enough rain at any given time to supplement for an irrigation.
Right.
And secondly, when the rains do come, they have a tendency to create more problems than they help in desert agriculture anywhere in the world. And it is, you have a tendency to get accumulations of salt on the surface of the soil from evaporation. And rains are high quality water. Uh-huh. And they'll come in and they'll do two things. They'll leach those salts back down onto the root zone. And they'll also have a tendency to disperse soils, because our soils are generally a little bit more saline and somewhat sodic. So they'll have a tendency to disperse. And then the third thing they can do, it can be a trick. is it's easy to think, so we got a rain, it feels good to us, everything must be good in the field, and so maybe we back off a little bit and being more assertive about irrigating. Happens at home, too. People can get caught up, and next thing you know, their plants are burning up.
We weren't watering. We had that great rain up at our home on Saturday.
Yes, sir.
And my wife said, well, let's don't water. And I said, I don't know about
that. There it is right there.
Well, I took my wife's advice, and we didn't water, but really, I guess that same thinking could go to the farmers.
Absolutely. So it's good just to keep track of how much rain you are getting as opposed to what you feel like. Now, out on the range, in the forests, that is a bigger problem because, of course, those systems depend completely on rainfall. So range conditions are getting dry. Forest conditions are dry. And so it's a hazard with regard to fire, but it's also just more dangerous habitat all the way around.
Jeff Silvertooth is with us. Jeff is our expert. He's our contributor on agriculture. And when I saw this story, I thought of Jeff immediately and try to get some more information about this. Scientists are researching the potential consequences of the rapid decline of the honeybee population in the United States and how to mitigate its effects before it causes dire problems for crop management and production. Honeybees are really important, aren't they, Jeff?
They certainly are. They're an important part of the ecosystem naturally. They're a very important part of our crop production ecosystems as well. And it is a concern for all of us. Matter of fact, general biological diversity is important to try to preserve. And we're very well aware of that in agriculture because the entire balance of the ecosystem is upset, it's disrupted to some extent by putting in a monoculture type of crop. And that would be even if you're looking at multiple cropping systems. So we have to really watch what's happening in terms of the biological diversity, and particularly insects and those types of members of that community are important to monitor. Honeybees have been, there's been a lot of concern about them. When I work out here in agriculture in Arizona, we use honeybees a lot. They're very important for pollination. Very important for pollination of a lot of regular crops like melons. I think of cantaloupes, honeydews, watermelons. Very important for pollination there. So we put bees out on the field. There are beekeepers that are employed regularly for that purpose. Also, we produce a lot of seed crops. Mm-hmm. And bees are used in the field to enhance pollination, to enhance seed production. And the beekeepers here, when I talk to the entomologist, now you introduced me as an administrator, which is true, but when I'm making an honest living, Bill, I'm an agronomist in the field, so I'm not an entomologist, but I work with our entomologists, and they tell me that these concerns are legitimate from bees and the population declines but we haven't seen a big problem here in Arizona in the crop production arena, but it's a serious concern.
I mean, big time, $170 billion in crops worldwide be attributed back to the honeybee.
Absolutely.
And the other pollinators. And so this is somewhat of a mystery of what's going on, right, mm-hmm. Jeff? So what is
going on?
What is going on?
The entomologist
tells
me.
I'm not
a really expert at that, but what I understand from it is winters are hard on honeybees in the first place. So the severity and the nature of the winters are hard. The quality of the habitat for foraging is important. And when that declines, like in a drought, that quality of habitat declines, then that's a factor. And depends on where the bees are set. Thirdly, they have pests, they have diseases, and the mites have been a problem that have come in. There's populations or species of mites that have infected honeybees in various parts of the United States and around the world. And that can be a real problem. Virus diseases can affect honeybees. So, I don't think anyone that I know of is absolutely certain what's going on. I think it depends on where you are and also how hard those populations have been worked. All those factors fit back in together. So it's how that animal is responding to its environment. But, one of the big concerns that we have, too, in agriculture particularly, is exposure to pesticides.
Uh-huh.
And particularly insecticides.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just another very good reason. And that can, by the way, cause declines of honeybees.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very good reason why what we encourage in the university and through our extension programs through integrated pest management is to utilize pesticides very judiciously, very carefully, and very conservatively.
I wondered. I haven't talked to you about your approach to pesticides.
Yeah, the best way to do it is what we call our integrated pest management programs. And that's when you look at the
It's kind of like integrated medicine. Absolutely.
Yeah. Very much the same kind of biological concept.
Yes.
You have to think about the pest of that species in the context of the entire ecosystem, not just that one species by itself, but how is it fitting all in? Now, so there are practices and procedures to go through that are appropriate best management practices with integrated pest management to consider diseases, insects, weeds, as well as the plants and all the biodiversity in the field. But one of the things that's helped us a lot, of course, as scientists, my colleagues that work in entomology and what we call IPM, integrated pest management, I've watched in my career for 42 years of professional career really improve on this. Our techniques are much better understood today and much better practiced. So that's what we advocate in our education programs. Second thing that's happened, Bill, that's been advantageous to help us as a tool are the pesticides or insecticides have become softer to the environment over time. They become very much more, I think, specified, it's almost surgical in their nature, much like medicine has evolved. You know, medicine's evolved tremendously in the past 40 years.
Well, that leads me to some personal experience with crop dusters. Early in my career, Jeff, I was in the news director at the radio station in Tulare County, Visalia, California, in the San Joaquin Valley. And when we first moved into our apartment there in Visalia, right next door was a field. And they were doing crop dusting. It seems like they would be dive bombing the area. And that stuff was like blowing our way. And I think, oh my goodness, that could not have been good. That was back in like 1974.
Right.
Has the approach, do they still do crop dusting?
They do crop dusting. But there again, it's a good point as well. So that's a method of application.
Okay.
But the pesticides that are being used today are much softer.
So the delivery system hasn't changed.
In some cases, it has.
But what they are carrying on board has
absolutely changed. There's the difference. Huge difference. Now, I was in the field in the 70s as an agronomist consultant. And I'm telling you that what we were using then was a lot harsher
in terms of
pesticides, insecticides, and what's available today. It's just incredible.
Oh.
There were pesticides back then that you had, they were just toxic to us, just because we're a bigger animal.
Yeah.
But then there are things we're using today, you and I can walk in the field safely.
Wow.
Right up behind those, right behind those insecticides. As a matter of fact, they're so surgical that a lot of times they only affect one species at one particular stage of growth.
Wow.
And so other species are not affected. So that's where we come back to the honeybees, and that's the kind of tools that we recommend. If you're going to have to spray, it's kind of like using an antibiotic. If you use an antibiotic, use it when you really need it.
Right.
And use the right one at the right time.
Right.
Same principle, same concept when it comes to these pesticides applied into fields for pest control.
Wow. Interesting. I always learn so many new things when Jeff Silvertooth is with us, and Jeff's going to stick around for another segment. We'll talk a little bit about hemp production here in Arizona. It's up and running. That as we continue on the Buckmaster Show on 1030, The Voice, your trusted source for independent news talk. Be right back.
Vero Amore is Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, panini, and salad is homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino and on Dove Mountain Boulevard in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore on the web at veroamore.com. Buckmaster Show listeners know about my love of travel and flying from Tucson International Airport. I know you value your time and money, so it makes sense to fly Tucson with nearly 60 daily nonstop flights to major hub airports. If you're flying to another airport to take a nonstop flight, you're still making a connection and spending 4 hours on the road traveling to that other airport. That's why I fly Tucson and encourage you to do the same. The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year transportation plan is funded through June 2026 by a special taxing district, which is a state-established political subdivision within Pima County. The RTA plan and half-cent excise tax were voter-approved in May 2006, and the tax is collected within the district. More about RTA's Citizens Advisory Committee's efforts to develop an RTA continuation plan at rtamobility.com.
vets working hard to save wildlife covered in cactus spines. A skunk left for dead, miraculously saved by a caring citizen. Those are just a couple of the headlines from the nonprofit Tucson Animal Rescue Center, where thousands of animals are cared for each year at its state-of-the-art Far East Side Tucson facility. Rescue, rehab, and release. The Tucson Wildlife Center, saving wildlife for more than two decades. Donate online at TucsonWildlife.com or call 290-WILD.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. We're on 1030 The Voice, your source here in Southern Arizona for trusted independent news talk. Dr. Jeff Silvertooth with us on the Buckmaster Show, our contributor on agriculture. And Jeff has been at the Arizona College of Agriculture, University of Arizona College of Agriculture and Life Sciences for a long time. And he's head of the Arizona Cooperative Extension. And for folks who don't know about the Cooperative Extension, I know we kind of explain it every time you're on the show, but it is important that University of Arizona is what's called a land grant institution. And with that goes for each of the states that, I think pretty much every state.
Yes, sir.
Right?
Every state. Yes,
every
sir.
State has a cooperative extension that has to do with agriculture. And that was formed why?
It was formed associated with the land grant institution so that the university would have a capacity to connect, take the university in to the public, to the people.
The knowledge that, yeah, yes, the sir. University.
Take it out to the people as opposed to people coming to the university.
Right.
And to bring science to bear on practical problems. And it has an agricultural orientation in the beginning, but it also includes what we call family consumer health sciences and 4-H youth development. Mm-hmm. So collectively, we actually cover a huge swath of information, and it's always usually been at this university associated with the College of Agriculture Life Sciences. A lot of universities, it crosses the entire campus.
Huh. And for those that say young people aren't involved anymore with agriculture, it's not true. 4-H is really thriving in this state.
Oh, my goodness. There are something like... 200,000 youth that we contact every year through our youth development programs through extension, and about 8,000 volunteers across the state engage with us as well. So it's a real community-based program, but we're part of the University of Arizona, and that's our mission, Bill, is to take the university to the people and bring science to bear on practical problems.
All right, we're hearing a lot about medical marijuana, and now there's going to be they'll be gathering the signatures and probably, I don't know, the way they usually work, they gather these signatures and they usually get on the ballot. That will be for recreational marijuana in 2020. But now hemp is, it's kind of related, right?
Mm-hmm. It's a cannabis. It's in the same genus. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So it's kind of related, but there's a commercial application to the hemp, correct?
Yes, sir. That's right.
Explain to our listeners what that's all about.
Commercial or industrial hemp is related to cannabis sativa, which is the what we think of the recreational and medicinal marijuana. Mm-hmm. The cannabis that is used for commercial or industrial purposes is used for fiber and some oil production, which primarily as a fiber crop. And it has clearance now for production in the United States on a commercial level because of the provisions that were included in the 2018 Farm Bill by the federal government. And then what that provides is an opportunity for each state to enlist in that program. Each state Department of Agriculture administers the licenses for growers. And what we had to have happen here is for the State Department of Agriculture in Arizona to get a permits or the licensing or approval of their plan for management from the USDA. That was approved, I guess, a couple months ago. And now they are distributing licenses to commercial producers as an experiment station, which you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Each experiment station site, for example, Yuma, Maricopa, Safford, each site has to apply for a license mm-hmm. through the Department of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. And we need a site license, and then we can conduct field research mm-hmm. on commercial hemp.
What do we know about it?
Not too much. Not enough.
How does it, I mean, are there areas
not
that
enough.
Do well?
We don't
climate?
Know.
We don't know.
But there's a ton of questions. It's kind of an exciting area for an agronomist or someone in the business right now, mm-hmm. but kind of a scary area, a lot of risk for a farmer. Mm-hmm. And people are out planting that stuff and growing it right now in the field as we speak, Bill.
What's their growing season?
Well, it's a warm season crop, so it'll be primarily through what we consider our warm seasons. But, you know, that brings up a good question. When's the best time to plant? What are the best seasons to grow? Because here in Arizona, we could grow crops 12 months of the year. Mm-hmm. But, for example, we grow winter vegetable crops in Yuma that mm-hmm. are leafy green vegetables that are grown in the Salinas Valley in mm-hmm. the summertime. Mm-hmm. We grow them here in the winter because of the favorable climate during the winter. Mm-hmm. We could never begin to do that in the summer.
No.
And so we grow different crops at different times of year as they fit. And that's one of the big questions we have with commercial hemp. What part of the seasons will it best fit? Mm-hmm. Well, how much water does it use? There's a mm-hmm. myth mm-hmm. that's running around in this state. Everywhere people are saying, you know, this stuff will save us 30% of our water.
I've heard that.
There's no foundation to that. Now, maybe it will, but we don't know that. Uh-huh. That's the point.
We don't know how water intensive it is.
No. We can guess. I mean, Paul Brown is our biometeorologist, and he's looked at data from Purdue, from Indiana. Of course, Indiana's environment, that's a lot different than Arizona. Sure. But you can try to translate that in terms of the meteorological conditions and take that crop into this environment. You know, based on Paul's estimates, and I've seen that, and I would agree, it's not going to be any different than the consumptive use for a crop like cotton if it's growing throughout that same length of growing season. Now, maybe we can grow it faster mm-hmm. in a shorter season. Maybe we can grow it earlier in the season and then grow a second crop, what we call late in the summer, into mm-hmm. the fall, particularly mm-hmm. at lower elevations. We don't know.
But it has no relation to the fiber of cotton. They're in a different...
No, it's a different purpose.
Different purpose. But hemp is used for clothing, isn't it?
It's used for clothing. It can be, but it's also used for like ropes and fibers. At one time, some types of hemp have been used for tire fibers, at long, mm-hmm. you know, kind mm-hmm. of desperate need. But it can primarily used for fibers associated with what we would think of as ropes and materials like
that. But then it became kind of illegal because of marijuana.
There's part of the problem. A good example, when the Department of Agriculture came out and put this in the Farm Bill for 2018, the Department of Justice didn't actually change. They say cannabis is cannabis to us. We don't care what it looks like. So we had to get that clarification done. Now, this stuff is going to be important because in the field, commercial hemp,
sure.
because it has to be less than, I think, 3% THC, which is the active ingredient that gives it that, you know, a medicinal purpose. Mm-hmm. And if it exceeds 3%, then it's considered as medicinal marijuana. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions we have, too, is what if growing conditions with some varieties produce THC levels that are greater than 3% under our conditions? Hmm. We don't know. That's a good point right there.
One of our callers, Andy, has called, and he has a question or a comment relating to hemp production. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, so I was reading some history books, and back in the Revolutionary War days, hemp was a cash crop, and they said in the book, I don't remember the name of the book or the author or anything, but it took 40 acres of hemp to rig a frigate-sized sailing ship.
Wow.
I think that's right, but it was used for that purpose, and it was grown back then. Matter of fact, it grows this kind of hemp. This kind of cannabis grows wild in some parts of the country. I come from Kansas and Oklahoma, and that's what was commonly called ditch weed back there, Andy. And, you know, Missouri up in the Midwest. But you're right. That's where it was first utilized. That's right.
Andy, any further comment there, sir?
I have a question, though.
Go ahead.
So if they did grow some of these hemp farms, would they have rotated their crops back then to keep the soil rich? I mean, they wouldn't grow hemp in the same place every time, or would they rotate the crops, basically?
And back in the times, the revolutionary times you're mm-hmm. talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they probably did, Andy. I mean, crop rotations have been common in crop production systems for centuries. That's not really new. But what people have learned that if you don't do that, there are bad things will happen eventually. If you stay into a monoculture system, meaning the same crop over and over in the same fields. So crop rotations were probably used if they had any kind of, if they were able to keep themselves in place, which it mm-hmm. looks like they have in that part of the country.
All right.
But I would guess, but I don't know specifically. I would think so, yes.
Jeff Silvertooth, always a pleasure. Jeff, we'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you, sir.
Likewise, sir. Thank you.
This portion of the Buckmaster Show presented by Green Things. Speaking of agriculture, that's very appropriate. One of our sponsors there, Jeff. Green Things, 3384 East River Road by the Rito River. 13-acre site. They've got all those beautiful plants, everything you need for the garden. They're also home to Zocalo. All that great merchandise, much of it handcrafted from Mexico, Latin America, and Europe. Visit Green Things, and you can visit their website, greenthingsaz.com. That's going to do it today for the Buckmaster Show. On behalf of Jeff Silvertooth, I am Bill Buckmaster. Also saying a big goodbye to is John Couch. Thanks, John, for your service on the other side of the glass, engineering and producing our program. Hope you have a great afternoon and evening.